Yeah, so I will be talking about work done in collaboration with Michael Friedman, Kirill Stengel, Kevin Walker, and Zhang'an Wang, who's also here. And the title of my talk is Quantum Loopgrass Approach to Topological States of Matter, which I apologize for introducing more terminology, because really quantum loopgrass is the same word. It's just different words for the same thing that Xiaogang Wen was talking about this morning with string condensation and what Mike was just saying about loops and nets and so on. Okay. So, you know, it's useful to have simple caricatures for physical systems and for an elastic medium. For instance, the surface of a drum is a very nice simple caricature which describes many states of matter. The ground state breaks a symmetry, and low-lying excitations can be thought of as ripples in the medium, which tend to restore the symmetry. And they're gapless, basically, because in the long wavelength limit, such a ripple is a symmetry operation. Now, this is a good picture for broken symmetry states. And in this talk, I'll describe states of matter for which the appropriate caricature, or I shouldn't make too strong a term, but a very useful caricature, is a sea of fluctuating loops. Now, these loops may arise in any number of different ways, as both Xiaogang Wen and Mike Friedman just said in their earlier talks. So I'm kind of repeating what they said here, but they can arise in many ways as domain walls. So for instance, if you have Ising spins on the triangular lattice, then the domain walls between them are loops on the hexagonal lattice. If you have a model of dimers, then the transition graph between some reference configuration and a dimer configuration of interest is also a loop. Actually, I didn't really give you the right example here by drawing the square lattice, which gives rise to directed loops, but a better example is the triangular lattice. Another example, occupied sites or up spins. So as Mike just described for us in his talk, this Kataev model, the up spins form loops. I haven't drawn in the down spins, so the rest of the spins on these links of this lattice are down, and the Hamiltonian, which I'll just repeat a little bit his description because it'll be useful a little bit later, the Hamiltonian is of this form, and one of the terms in the Hamiltonian basically multiplies together the four spins around any site, and the Hamiltonian is satisfied when the operator is plus one, which tells you that you should have either two up spins and two down spins around any vertex, or four up spins around a vertex, or four down spins, okay, which tells you that therefore you have loops which never terminate. Okay. Now these loops are going to obey, so thinking about this in terms of loops is just some way, some picture for a basis set of states in this theory. And of course, this is really quantum mechanical, so these states can be superposed, and they'll obey some kind of quantum dynamics. And what we'd like to do is think of that quantum dynamics as imposing some topological rules on these loops. And depending on the nature of those topological rules, the state may be a stable gap topological state, or since we really have to be careful about what we can really prove. So as Mike said, it's very likely that it could be a stable gap topological state, or it could be a gapless critical point, or as Eduardo was raising his question, it could be some boring, quote unquote, boring broken symmetry phase. Okay. Now, as I said, these loops arise in various ways, and excitations, okay, you can think of as violations of these rules. Okay, so one kind of violation is an endpoint. Okay, and the rules which these loops obey determine the topological properties in which we're interested, such as braiding properties of quasiparticles, ground state degeneracy, and so on. Now, the basic structure of a class of theories is wave functions defined psi of alpha on multi-loops alpha, which are invariant under smooth deformations of the loops. So again, as I said, you can talk about a basis set of states as being described by configurations of multi-loops or classical configuration space. And so the wave function, you give it some picture like this, and the wave function gives you a complex number. Okay, and you could of course keep in mind that a picture like this really means that you have up spins on a variety on all of these states and down spins elsewhere, or you have some dimer configuration or something like that. Okay. And so one rule that this wave function have to satisfy is invariance under smooth deformations. So you can see this picture is practically the same as this, except this loop over here has gotten slightly deformed. Okay. And so we're going to assume that the Hamiltonian, or we're going to be interested in Hamiltonians, which impose a relation like this. Okay. This is pretty much you'd expect for any topological phase, that it shouldn't really depend on details, these sorts of details of these kinds of loops. So, yes?
So this is just for ground state, or is this true for
the... This is just for ground, this is just for the low energy subspace in which we'll be interested, which will include the ground state. Okay? So that's a very important point. So when I write equations like this, what I really mean is the low energy subspace should satisfy rules of this form. Another way of saying it is that the Hamiltonian perhaps could be written as a sum of projection operators, which vanishes whenever you have a linear combination of these two states, and gives you an energetic penalty otherwise. Okay. So if you're going to be thinking about topological phases, the last transparency was obvious, that it had to be invariant under topological deformations. Now, the next condition you might expect wave functions in the low energy subspace to satisfy is that there'd be some kind of, quote, fugacity, D, for small contractible loops, which is to say that the wave function evaluated on a picture like this should be D times the wave function evaluated on a picture like the one on the right, where I've erased this loop over here. Okay. Now, the reason that you would really want something like this is, let's take this model and put it, let's say, on the sphere or some topologically trivial manifold with no excitations and just look at the ground state. Okay. Then, if you don't have a relation like this, and you can see that even if you have full topological invariance under smooth deformations, there still are, you can have any number of loops on the sphere, and so you would still have an enormous number of different independent wave functions. Okay. But with a relation like this, those all collapse, and you really would have a unique ground state, say on the sphere, or a topologically trivial manifold. In Kataev's model, which I mentioned earlier, D is equal to 1, but we're going to allow D to, for the moment, we'll just allow D to be any other number. Okay. Now, finally, we're going to demand invariance. So the first relation, invariance under continuous deformations, you couldn't even get off the ground without that. The second one, you needed to have at least a non-degenerate ground state on the sphere. And now, if you think about some other manifold like the torus, then clearly these loops could give you arbitrarily large winding numbers. And if you'd like to have finite degeneracy on the torus, then you also need some kind of surgery relation. Here I've given you the example that's appropriate for the D equals 1 theory, okay, or the simplest relation you can imagine, which is that you do this surgery over here, you cut these two loops and rejoin them in this different way. Okay. So these are three basic types of relations that we're going to want to have in models of this form. And by generalizing the latter two conditions from what they are in the Kataev model, which is this simple surgery relation here and D equals 1, okay, we'll construct a family of topological states of matter, all of which will have this description as some kind of quantum loop gases.
Oh, so
yes?
You're really describing a particular special state that lies in topological phase, right?
Correct.
You could presumably change, deform the Hamiltonian, deform the
absolutely
ground state, and then it seems to me the relative coefficients of some of these configurations you mentioned would change. You wouldn't, the numerical ratio wouldn't have to be exactly D.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I guess Shivaji was asking kind of a similar question. Presumably, although I don't really know how to do this, there's some kind of coarse grain limit in which, or some sense of coarse graining in which this is what it would be exactly, but I don't know.
I mean, the line tension has to normalize zero.
I think what you're describing is a particularly nice trial wave
function. Trial wave function,
function.
Sure.
Nice in the Laughlin state, which is a trial wave function.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And it's exact for a certain
Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Which also
yeah. Well, okay, yeah, that is, yeah, okay. Okay. I think that will become a little clearer momentarily. So this all has a relation to field theories that describe these topological phases and will make some more sense in that context. What I meant was, if you need some relation, some kind of surgery condition, otherwise, that is to say, if you have a model, so the assumption is that you have a model of this form, okay? And if you have a model of this form, then indeed, if you don't have a surgery relation, then you can have loops with arbitrary winding numbers, okay? So, we would like to generalize this structure, and if D is not equal to 1, then the surgery relation would have to be modified, or else there could be a contradiction, okay? Which is, if you take psi on some complicated picture, but with, let's say, a bit of curve in here, and then you deform it like this, apply the surgery, and then get rid of this little loop, you see, unless D equals 1, you're going to have some kind of contradiction between these two, okay? So, this is already telling us that this kind of structure is very highly constrained, and so if we want to generalize it, we're going to have to start looking at these more complicated types of surgery relations, like what Mike was mentioning in the previous talk. Okay. Now, if you try to surmount the problem I just described in the last transparency, then there's an important mathematical result here, which is that for almost all D, there is no way of finding a consistent surgery relation. And in fact, the consistent relations can only be found for D equals 2 times cosine of pi over k plus 2. These are these things called the Jones-Wenzel projectors. And for instance, for D equals the square root of 2, it looks like this. So the wave function evaluated on some configuration which has in it, somewhere in it, 3 strands coming close together like this, can then be related to the wave function on some nearly identical pictures, but with these modifications made in those pictures. K plus 1 is the number that you need, yeah. Now, with a relation like this in hand, okay, you can then go ahead and do all kinds of computations of things you might be interested in just by drawing pictures. So for instance, what you can see is, now if I look at some excitations, which would be endpoints of these loops, okay, and I start braiding them, if I do a counterclockwise exchange of these two, and then a counterclockwise exchange of these two, I end up with a picture that looks like this. Had I done the counterclockwise exchange in the opposite order, you see I end up with a different looking picture. And except for D equals 1, where I have a relation on 2 strands, and these two can actually be shown to be equal to each other, okay? In general, these are not going to be equal to each other. And that's, in this simple picture, that's where the non-abelian braiding statistics comes from, the fact that these different pictures are going to end up looking different depending on how you do these operations.
Okay.
Yes?
And how do you reconcile that?
There isn't. So you don't have a relation on 2 strings. You start with a relation on 3. So there's no relation on 2 strands, and there's one relation on 3, which is right here, for D equals square root of 2. And if D is equal to the golden mean, there's no relation on 2 or 3 strands. There's only a relation on 4 strands, which is this 15-term relation that Mike mentioned. Okay. And these get progressively more complicated as you go to higher K. Okay. So for K equals 2 again, so you can then see that if I start doing complicated braidings where I wind one particle around another in some complicated way, then you can use this relation to reduce these sorts of things to simpler pictures, okay, and figure out what the braiding matrices are for these states. You can also see, for instance, that there would be 9 ground states on the torus in this theory because the winding numbers, you can use this relation to always reduce the winding numbers so that around any direction they could be 0, 1, or 2, but you'll never get winding number 3, or if you get winding number 3, you can always reduce it to simpler ones. So, this is a very simple way of summarizing all of the content of this theory, and in some sense, by taking that approach, you're sort of doing an end run around field theory, you're starting with some microscopic model, and instead of figuring out what the effective field theory is and then solving the effective field theory, you're taking this microscopic model and just figuring out what the topology behind it is, and then using that to figure out, to compute things, okay? But you certainly could get the same results out of a field theoretic description, and it's somewhat instructive to think about this. The associated field theories with the these pictorial descriptions that I just discussed are gauge theories. The braiding statistics, which you just saw in this very simple way from the fact that these loops can't break and you can get quite complicated windings, that comes out of a generalized Aronoff-Bohm effect. The key insight is to realize that the operators in the gauge theory, which correspond to pictorial operations, are Wilson loop operators. And as Mike pointed out in his discussion of the rumor Teller-Weil theorem, the fact that these loops are unoriented is related to the fact that this is the group is SU2. Okay. And so the theories that one should be looking at in this context are these double, so-called doubled SU2 level K Chern-Simons theories. The Chern-Simons theory has an action, which I've written here. It looks wonderful, but you don't actually do all that much with it, aside from figuring out what the algebra is associated with some important gauge invariant operators, okay, which are these Wilson loop operators. And you know, the way in which one thinks about these theories, as you've already seen from the talks so far today, is very different from the way in which we think about most other field theories that we look at. And you know, it's not necessarily easier or harder, it's just that it's a different problem in the sense that you're not really trying to diagonalize a Hamiltonian, but rather you have some, in principle, complicated algebra and you just need to represent it. So the Hamiltonian for this theory is zero, and all of the juice is coming out of the fact that when you take the commutator of two Wilson loop operators, you get on the right hand side some other Wilson loop operators which are acting with, you know, defined on curves that have been obtained from the original two curves by some kind of cutting and joining operation. And so the algebra which I just showed you in the previous transparency, okay, can be represented on wave functions of exactly the form that I was discussing in the beginning of this talk, namely these wave functionals on isotopy or de-isotopy and surgery invariant wave functions. And basically Wilson loop operator acts on such a wave function by just the argument of this wave function is now the, whatever it was originally, union with the argument of the Wilson loop operator with the one extra bit of structure that if these two intersect, then you have to resolve the intersections, and you resolve the intersections in a very particular way in which this K enters, okay? And you need this in order to get the algebra correct. So what you do is, if you have some picture here that the wave function is being evaluated on, you act with a Wilson loop operator, you just take this Wilson, the loop, you just write it down on top of the picture you're interested in, be careful about the overcrossings, and then you just realize that wherever you have a crossing, you should now have the wave function evaluated on these two resolutions with appropriate coefficients. And this structure is now highly overdetermined. So in addition to showing that you get the desired commutation relations, it also fixes D. So in particular, it should be invariant under continuous deformations of, let's say, gamma, which is the argument of the Wilson loop operator. Well, if I continuously deform gamma so that I had a situation like this, then in principle, you get a different answer, unless when you use the resolution of crossings, you can get that different answer to all cancel out if and only if D is precisely what you wanted it to be, okay? So this is all a very highly overdetermined structure, and in the sense that there's something special about this particular way of writing the wave functions is that, you know, with these special coefficients and so on, it's that this is, not only are they convenient, but it's also in some sense exactly what the long wavelength field theory is all about. Okay. Yes?
The condition of the wave is all in the
Yeah, so again, as I was saying, the problem that you're trying to solve with, you know, a theory like this is you know, you have some kind of commutator algebra, and the trick that what you're trying to do is you're trying to figure out what the vector space is on which it can be represented, what the representations are of this algebra. And the representations are wave functions of this form that have this kind of cross-resolution built in, okay? So that's, I mean, another way of saying it is that resolution is dictated because you want it to represent that algebra, and if you didn't have that, it wouldn't do that, okay? So just to kind of summarize how all this fits together, and I think this is very similar to a transparency in Mike's talk at the beginning of his transparency, is that we have these different physical descriptions at different scales, okay? At short scales, you're really thinking about zero-dimensional objects like electrons or spins, which are living at points, and they obey some Hamiltonian like this, maybe an electronic Hamiltonian, which is just local operators at points. At intermediate scales, we kind of forget about all this and we just describe this in terms of fluctuating loops, okay, which are one-dimensional objects. And then at the longest scale, we can forget about even these and just think about how many degenerate ground states you have on the torus or some other higher genus surface, and everything is 2D. So in some sense, as you flow to longer length scales, you're also changing your viewpoint, the perspective on which you're focusing from zero dimension to one dimension to two dimensions. Okay. Now, I guess what I've been saying here, or what I've been focusing on here, is these intermediate scales, okay, where everything is in terms of these fluctuating curves and loops, and also in Xiaogang's talk, in talking about string condensation and so on, again, the same thing. One is trying to understand how microscopic models that maybe are given to you in some material will end up giving you these kinds of interesting phases at long wavelengths, and a particular way of getting there is by passing through these kinds of intermediate scale descriptions. Okay. Now, thinking a little bit more about this description, okay, at intermediate scales, it's useful to keep in mind that oftentimes an intermediate scale description of a problem is actually sort of the physics of a nearby critical point. Okay. In this case, the intermediate length scale physics is really just determined by d-isotopy. Okay. The long wavelength physics is determined by Jones-Wenzel-Sergey relations. Those are the things which restrict winding numbers, okay, and determine the energy gap. But the winding numbers, let's say on the torus, that's all very long wavelength physics at a scale at which you already know that you're on a torus as opposed to a sphere or something like that. But all the intermediate length scale physics is really determined by d-isotopy. Okay. And so, if you want to think of the intermediate scale physics for these topological phases as being really the physics of a nearby critical point, then that nearby critical point is defined really by d-isotopy. In the following sense that, for instance, on the sphere, you don't really need the Jones-Wenzel relation at all, because you can always shrink something down and then just get rid of it by contraction. Okay. So yes, Jones-Wenzel is related to when you bring things close together, but in some sense at intermediate scales, it's redundant, because D is by itself is enough to do anything. With loops that are sufficiently small, D by itself and isotopy are enough to do the job, in essence. So it's in that sense.
So on the sphere, it seems you don't need the Jones-Wenzel. So that means
for the ground state, for the ground state, yeah.
That means if you have a local Hamiltonian, yes, which has a d-isotope, yeah, and right on a sphere,
yep,
that means you will have a gap.
No, that's exactly what I'm coming to, though. Excellent question, though. Okay, so to kind of talk a little bit more about Xiaogang's question, let's think about models which have only d-isotopy, okay, which by the logic we were just discussing, those might be nearby critical points, which are sort of determining intermediate scale physics. Well, if we put spins on the links of a honeycomb lattice and write down some rather complicated looking Hamiltonian like this, this imposes d-isotopy. Now, this is unfortunately cumbersome to write out in this form, but the basic physics behind it is actually very simple. So if you remember back to what the Kataev model was, there were operators on plaquettes and operators on vertices. It's basically the same kind of operator on vertices that tells you that you have loops, and the loop that goes into a vertex has to come out. Here, basically, I've had to mutilate his plaquette term, basically because I want to get rid of, his plaquette term includes surgery, and I want to get rid of the surgery. So basically, we've got here something that only imposes isotopy and gets rid of small contractible loops. Okay, so this is cumbersome, but in fact, what it does is very simple. It imposes d-isotopy, okay, and only d-isotopy, no surgery. Now, as Shagang pointed out, of course, on the sphere, this is exactly the same. This annihilates precisely the same ground state as the theory with the Jones-Wenzel on the sphere. Okay, and that will be very. No, they're not commuting with each other. So that's an important difference. You actually need surgery to make this whole thing into a sum of commuting operators. Okay. However, even though they don't commute with each other, they do all annihilate the ground state. Okay. The ground state is indeed the same as it is in the topological phase. Let's say we're living on the sphere, and the ground state is just sum over all configurations, and it gets a coefficient here of d to the number of loops. Okay. Now, we can interpret this as a loop gas of phi gaussity d squared, in the sense that if I take the square of this wave function, the norm square of this wave function is in fact equal to the partition function of a classical statistical mechanical model, which is a so-called ON loop gas at a particular value of n and at a particular value of the inverse temperature. Okay. The ON loop gas are defined in the following way. You have a partition function, and it's just spheres living on, let's say, the honeycomb lattice, and with a rather odd-looking Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is the log of this expression here. So e to the minus beta h is then this. And if you were to now take the high temperature series expansion, which is the small x expansion of this, expand it out, you would get a sum over all loops on the honeycomb lattice with loops weighted in this way, depending on the length of the loop and the number of loops that you have. Now, one can just as well skip the intermediate step of having spins on the lattice and simply define this to be the partition function of what's called an ON loop gas model, or an ON loop model. And this partition function is perfectly well defined even if n is not an integer, and it's perfectly well defined even if x is not small. Okay, so for x not small it's not even necessarily the same theory as what you have over here, but it's a perfectly well defined theory. Okay, and if I set x equal to n, you can see the length penalty cancels out. And if I set n equal to d squared, this partition function is exactly the same as the norm square of the wave function that we're interested in. And so this is just like Laughlin's plasma analogy, where Laughlin observed you take the square of his ground state wave function, that thing looks like the Boltzmann weight for a Coulomb for a plasma, right? Well, here it's the same thing. This norm square of this wave function is equal to this loop model. And in fact, this loop model is studied and solved by Coulomb gas methods, so in fact it's also some kind of plasma.
What correlation functions would tell on whether or not it's critical?
The loop gas model, you mean? Yeah. So I'll come to that in a second. So So for x equals n, for n less than 2, this ON loop model is in its critical low temperature phase. So in fact, this model has a low temperature critical phase, and in that phase, there's a sequence of exponents of this form, which is determined by n. Okay, and these are exponents which you would interpret in terms of the original spins, spin-spin correlation function, you know, two spins at neighboring sites, their correlation function, and so on. In terms of loops, you could think of those as being, let's say, if you put in two endpoints, what's the partition function in that case, or if you have two loops coming nearby. So these are all kinds of correlation functions in this classical model with these exponents. Okay. Yes.
But this critical phase, that means gapless, or it could still be gap?
Yeah, so the classical statistical mechanical model is gapless, right? But we, I've not yet told you about the quant. So we'll get to the quantum model that we're really interested in a second. So right now, all I'm telling you about really is ground state properties, because I'm telling you about a classical statistical mechanical model which tells you about the ground state. I haven't said anything yet about excited states, or in fact, thus far, I haven't even said anything about the Hamiltonian. So, right. So I really can't answer that question yet. Now, just to point out one other thing that's useful is if you consider the x. So x equals n was the special point where it's exactly our wave function, okay? And I guess this comes back to Nick's comment. Of course, I could take x greater than n, right? And x greater than n is still in the same phase, still has the same exponents, still the same physics as far as this ground state wave function is concerned. And in fact, the x equals infinity limit, goes to infinity limit, becomes now the critical self-dual q equals n squared state Potts model, okay? Which has the same exponents as the low temperature critical phase ON model. Okay, so it's up to, it's a matter of taste where you want to live, and you could think about this in terms of this critical self-dual Potts model or low temperature ON model. And this tells us a lot about the ground state properties now. And in particular, the ground state contains long loops. Okay, that's what this criticality means. They're long loops. They're characterized by these exponents, which you know in terms of n. But in terms of the original spin model that we're interested in, these arise in correlations of non-local operators, okay? Things that refer to the same loop. So, for instance, the easiest case to think of this, perhaps, is the Q equals 1 situation, which is percolation, the Q equals 1 state Potts model. Well, if you have two spins far apart, the likelihood that they're both pointing up in percolation is a half. Right, or a quarter, I guess. But the probability that they're both up and on the same percolating cluster, that's a thing which is a power law, okay? So correlation functions of the local operators in the spin model, they're short-ranged, okay? It's correlations of non-local operators, which are actually non-local, or which are actually power law and which these exponents refer to. And actually, as Xiaogang pointed out, a trivial way to, or another way, a perspective of seeing this is the fact that there is a gapped model with the exact same ground state. And that gapped model, obviously, since it's a sum of commuting local operators, obviously that model has all of its correlations of local operators are short-ranged. Okay, so what we have here is a situation, maybe quasi-topological phase is perhaps a good way to describe it. We have a situation in which you have power laws, but those power laws are associated with non-local operators, okay, rather than local operators. So it's quasi in the sense that perhaps that a quasi long-range ordered phase is quasi. Now, the low energy excitations of this system, as Mike mentioned in his talk, there isn't a gap, okay? And a simple trial wave function is basically, if I had a plus, so X is configurations with long loops, Y is those configurations which don't have long loops. In some sense, they can be made precise, but I won't bother doing that right now. And basically, instead of having coefficient d to the number of loops, for all of these configurations, in some cases, I'll put in a minus sign here if the configuration doesn't have long loops. And since the ON model is critical for n less than or equal to 2, you can certainly define long in such a way that the probability is a half for having a long loop, so that, sorry, there shouldn't be psi 1 and psi 1, but psi 1 and psi 0, the overlap between those two wave functions. So this is true, so you can certainly make this so that it's orthogonal to the ground state, and furthermore, you can show that the expectation value of that Hamiltonian is 0 in this state, okay? Or I should say goes as, you know, some inverse power of the system size, okay? Basically because the reason is that the two sectors of the configuration space are not directly connected by the Hamiltonian. So in some sense, the configuration space looks like this. Configurations large loops, configurations without large loops, and you're considering a trial wave function that's basically going between 1 and minus 1. Well, the Hamiltonian basically only connects states over here with themselves and states over here, and so you kind of never really detect this minus sign difference, okay? And so therefore, because of the gaplessness that we have here, what we have is a critical line here parameterized by d less than or equal to square root of 2. The reason square root of 2, again, is because the ON model for n greater than 2 is not critical, or the Q-state POTS model for Q greater than 4 doesn't have a second-order phase transition, but a first-order phase transition. So this is a critical line parameterized by d less than or equal to square root of 2. And it's obviously a very interesting theory because its equal time correlation functions are short-ranged in spite of the fact that it's critical, but some non-local operators have power laws.
But in terms of the loop, sorry, if you force in an end of one loop and the end of another loop and then calculate the efficient function with that like a string or whatever.
Yeah.
Is that exponentially retained?
Well, I mean, that, you know, no, well, maybe it's a little easier to answer this. So if I, let's say that some piece of loop is over here and some piece of loop is over here. Okay, let me not put in endpoints, but let me just say there's some section of loop over here and some section of loop over here. That is short-ranged.
I know, but I want to put the endpoints.
But the endpoints is now considering some excited state. I mean, yeah, the endpoints, that's power law, sure. But that's not a correlation function of anything, of any local operator in the underlying quantum model, right? You're now putting in something that's got strings in its definition.
Yeah,
sure.
But when I just
I mean, the answer to your question is yes. If I put in, so, so in the...
greater than root 2, if I think of these fluctuating lines, electric field lines, that's confined.
Right? Correct, yeah.
That's a way to think about it.
That's a way to think about it, yes. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is a way to think about it, but I think I'll introduce another way that maybe is well, which is probably, anyway. So I'll use another way to think about it in a second. So anyway, so we've got this critical line, and it would be awfully nice to obviously, if we've got a critical line, I mean, there's not a whole lot of them that we know, so it would be nice to understand a little bit better, and in particular to understand, for instance, low-energy field theory for this line. I mean, an effective field theory would help us address a number of questions. You could address the stability. As Mike was we were just talking about in the discussion end of Mike's talk, you kind of want to know if there's one relevant direction or multiple relevant directions. You could discuss dynamics because I was just now only talking about equal time correlation functions and so on. So there are a couple clues that we can use to try to guess what this might be. One is that omega has to go as k squared. I didn't go into the details of the argument, but in that variational argument, in fact, the gap goes as 1 over the system size squared, okay, which implies that omega is going as k squared, not as k. We expect that this thing would be an SU2 gauge theory because, after all, we're talking about unoriented loops and everything we've been talking about here is SU2 gauge theories. The local operators should have equal time correlations which are short-ranged, but non-local operators should have some power laws or should have exponential decay, sorry, power law decay characterized by exponents like this.
All this for arbitrary d below the square root of 2.
All this for arbitrary d below the square root of 2, exactly. So we can make an educated guess here. Okay, the first two requirements were telling us that you needed omega goes as k squared, and the second requirement, you know, the second requirement is telling us it's SU2 gauge theory. So if we were to write down here an SU2 gauge theory, so here, I are spatial indices, and these A's are SU2 indices. But this is an SU2 gauge theory. The only difference between this and Maxwell, or sorry, Yang-Mills theory, is that rather than E squared here, we have E squared times the covariant derivative squared E. Okay. So you can check that this theory is, in fact, a theory which has omega goes as K squared. Okay. Now, this is in fact an interacting theory because these are all secretly have nonlinear terms inside them. The magnetic field in a non-abelian gauge theory is not just linear in the gauge field but has a quadratic piece, and this covariant derivative has now got also the gauge field inside of it. So this is an interacting theory. And so what we'd like to know is if, first of all, if this theory is actually critical, and secondly, if it has anything to do with the critical line that we've just been discussing. So to answer the first question, whether it's actually critical, the first thing you can do is compute the beta function for this theory and just see what happens. Now, it turns out that at one loop, it's exactly equal to 0. Okay. And the implication is that if this survives to higher loops, that this theory is also on a critical line. Okay. Yes?
The E squared term may be generated here.
Yeah, sure. So No, that's certainly true. The E squared term is relevant and would be generated. So if we stay at E squared equals zero.
So you'll tune
that. Yeah, but we're tuning one parameter is certainly tuned to be on this line. At least one parameter, right, is tuned to be on this line. Okay. But it's already pretty significant because you can see this is an interacting theory, and actually not having relativistic invariance means that the number of vertices gets out of hand very quickly, but somehow they all manage to conspire to give you this equal to zero. This is classically scale invariant. The reason is that because time scales as x squared, in fact, the classical scaling is a lot like four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. But again, as I was saying, because you don't have relativistic invariance, for one thing, it's not a good idea to integrate out E and get some kind of nasty theory in terms of the gauge field A. And secondly, the number of diagrams you have to compute to do a one-loop calculation is something like 40. So it gets to be a very big calculation, but the organization is such that here, E and A actually enter in a very similar way, and so somehow E and A tend to cancel each other out in the calculation, and you end up with a beta function that vanishes. So if this survives beyond one loop, then this is a statement that this theory is also on a critical line. Okay?
Yes? If you fine-tune to get the E squared term
yes.
to vanish, generically, if you perturb it, you'll generate it.
Correct.
And
yeah.
you'll confine.
That's absolutely right. So you have to tune one parameter. What?
Then the gate theory will confine.
Yeah.
And then you're...
No, I agree. So you have to get onto this critical line, you have to tune at least one parameter.
Some other one,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's the conclusion. That's correct. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Now, in fact, the situation is slightly worse than that, at least for some values of G, because for G small, you actually have quartic perturbations, basically the electric field to the fourth power. Those have runaway flows. But this actually corresponds to something we already know, because for d greater than or equal to square root of 2, which is sort of the classical limit, which is g small, you know, we know that these theories are gapped anyway, as are the q-state pots and ON models. So, in fact, for g small, the question you were asking earlier, Matthew, is that, yes, they're kind of they're confined theories, and they are confining for d greater than or equal to square root of 2, basically because of some runaway flows of some other quartic terms. Is a way to think about it, okay? And so even if you tune the E squared term to zero, they're still confining when D is greater than or equal to square root of 2, which is actually kind of an interesting way of thinking about why the Potts model is first order for a large Q, or the ON model, although somewhat roundabout. Yes, square root of 2, thank you. In fact, in a model like this, D can't be greater than 2, because if G equals 0, you have D equals 2. So, now, if this conjecture is correct, then for D sufficiently large, however, these operators become irrelevant. And in this regime, you expect things like this Wilson loop operator to have expectation value D, and some non-local correlation functions, which are gauge invariant, like electric field, with Wilson lines connecting them to have these kinds of these exponents for the power law decays that we were talking about. Okay. So, to summarize, what I've been trying to argue here is that there's this pictorial combinatorial description of topological phases, and with those in hand, there are these open questions one would like to address. Now, I've kind of talked about electrons, topology, statistical mechanics, gauge theories, but the title of the session, I guess, is topological quantum computation, and I haven't mentioned that at all. But fortunately, John Preskill is giving the next talk, and he'll explain all of that. But the one point that I would like to make here is that, if one is hoping to use this for topological quantum computation, then you know, recognizing that the pictorial representation motivates certain types of models, okay, and that one would like to perturb away from the soluble models where you're imposing exactly the relations you want, which are diisotopy and Jones-Wenzel, towards more realistic ones. As Mike said, you know, imposing the Jones-Wenzel relations seems kind of hopeless for the larger ones, and you'd like to sort of get them out of maybe some generic perturbation. To understand that, you know, stability of the diisotopy critical line is a question that you want to answer. And so one should consider very seriously this field theory and just how stable or unstable it is towards various terms. Now, the generic E squared line tension term is, of course, very strongly relevant at G equals zero. But actually, we're interested here in G not equals zero. Actually, G is whatever it is. We don't know what G has to be in order for D to be less than the square root of 2. And at that G, the anomalous dimension may be such that E squared term isn't relevant. That's a question that needs to be answered. Or maybe even if it is relevant, it may not be very relevant. So
does it go in the right direction?
Don't know yet. Stability. So this is a question that you have to answer because you really want to know how difficult, if the idea is we're going to get into these topological phases by going by these nearby critical points, then you do want to know how stable this critical line, I should say, not this critical line is. Okay. And just as a, sorry, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Are you having ever made E squared less relevant than grad of E squared?
The question is, that operator may or may not be relevant, right? It depends on what its dimension is. And at tree level, for G equals zero, it's relevant, but it may be irrelevant later, right, when you tune up the coupling constant.
But then grad E squared is cast.
No, that's a different operator. Yeah. I mean, look, if you look at a Luttinger liquid, which is a fixed line, there are various operators there, which as you tune the Luttinger parameter, some operators which are relevant at tree level become irrelevant later. Sure. That certainly happens. Okay, so just quick, I didn't put any references in this talk, so I just wanted to mention a few at the end. So there are these various foundational papers on topological quantum field theories and associated topology, number of papers written by us on this quantum loop gas ideas, and of course, Mike Levin and Xiaodong Wen with their very equivalent ideas, a little bit about classical stat mech of classical loop models, and of course, the critical point that I was critical line that I was discussing here, of course, has a lot of similarities to some critical points other people have been discussing recently. Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, why do you restrict yourself to the category of SU2 transimons as opposed to, what is the role of SUN transimons?
There isn't any very good reason other than that it's simpler, in the sense that for, let's say, SU3 or SU4, the basic pictorial description is more complicated, kind of like what Mike was saying with colors on the loops or arrows, so there's just more structure. Maybe we should think about them more seriously. I guess the idea was just that these simple ones were complicated enough, and maybe...
If you're going to discuss the class of topological,
sure,
2D topological phases, they would have to contain at the very least all SUN, things,
sure,
in the class of all SUN level K for any N and any K.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think the motivation for SU2 is because the loop's not oriented.
Right.
I just wonder whether there are some other group which also corresponds to non-oriented loop. I wonder whether SPN have a such thing. SON, yeah. Then one may equally say, well, maybe this non-oriented loop corresponds to SPN or SON, something like that.
Yeah, some other group which has a fundamental representation that's real or pseudo-real, like SU2. I mean, yeah, it could be. I don't know. Yeah, I guess so.
Paul?
Mm-hmm.
In this model at the end, how do you imagine perturbing, assuming it is critical, how do you imagine perturbing it to get one of these topological phases? What sort of perturbations are going to do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, you know, it may be that you need to condense some otherwise massive field which has the right quantum numbers associated. I mean, Jones-Wenzel projectors, you think, are in some sense correspond to, you know, the different Jones-Wenzel projectors in some sense correspond to different representations of, you know, the SU2 Katz-Moody, and so maybe you need to condense some field associated with that representation.
So you have to add a matter field somehow?
Maybe matter field, or maybe there's some way of building it up actually out of the gauge field. I don't know the answer to that, but I presumably it has something to do with, you know, this K has something to do with the maximal representation in SU2 that you're allowed to have, and so it presumably has something to do with that. But the details, I have no idea at this point.
Any more questions? Well, I guess after the break, we will learn how to use this, probably. We're back at 4:30 for John Preskill's talk.